after all that we see that happened to Jesus, the Christ himself was traumatized. His body was traumatized. But you know why? The power of the possibility said, this is not the last word. I'm going to give you this glorified body. This is where our hope comes in. No matter what happened, we are not only disasters, we are also miracles.
Last week, Matthew Wickman and Patrick St. John began their discussion of Patrick's remarkable new book, titled The Spiritual Work of Racial Justice, A Month of Meditations with Ignatius of Loyola. They talked about Patrick's international background, as he is a native of Haiti and has degrees from universities in France, Mexico, and the United States. Patrick also shared insights from his spiritual life, including the story of his conversion as a Jesuit regent. Today, Matt and Patrick will continue their discussion about anti-racism as a spiritual journey facilitated by exercises from his book, and will move beyond the page to talk about what we can do to change our perspectives and be active servants for needed spiritual and social change.
Kind of transition here to week two, and week two is titled Christ as a Person of Color, and you point out, you know, you talk about white savior complex, and you remark that people of color don't need whites to save them. In fact, you say, I'll quote you here, just the opposite, whites need the Jesus who is present in people of color. And this is what I think, if I could underscore this, one of the things that you really are bringing out here in our conversation is that if we really want to draw closer to God, we need to begin to see diversity much more broadly than we do, and find ways to be inclusive of others and to expand our horizons of perception, expand our imaginations. And if we do that, we'll deepen our spirits.
Because that's what happened here in the second week of the exercises, as Ignatius really like invite us to work with the grace of like incarnations and the contemplation of Jesus Christ will become just like us. That's where everything's began, Mark. We go back here. How can I pray for the grace of seeing Christ and find Christ in everyone and everything?
That's wonderful. It's a great vision. In this second week, you give a really provocative reading of Jesus's parable of the Good Samaritan. And you remark, and I'm quoting you here, that it helps you better understand the way many whites define racism versus the way people of color define racism. I'm wondering if you could walk us through your interpretation of the parable of the Good Samaritan and expound on that point about how whites perceive racism versus how people of color perceive racism.
Thank you very much, man. This is, again, it's a point that took me a lot of prayer, actually, on this chapter.
I'll bet it did, yeah.
Yes, because, you know, how to really, like, balance that without moving from this place of, like, judging, yeah, accusing, and to this place of, like, inclusivity without any discriminations. How can we move from this place of otherness? I am not them. This is you. From this place of us. How can we balance this language versus I to we and the complexity that we are having today? The questions of really like this, the parable of the Samaritan language, I think it's more than ever very important to us today in this conversation that we're having in our country, in our lives, in our house. It's such important, like how we can ask God for the grace to make these transitions from them to us.
Yeah, great. Go through that parable here just for a minute here. So just to kind of refresh, and I'm sure most of our listeners are very familiar with it, but just in case, a man is walking along a highway, along a traveling way, a road, and is beaten up by thieves and left for dead. And while he's there, this is a man in Jesus's part of the world. He's Jewish. And while he's there on the ground, beaten up and hurt, a priest walks by, sees the man, and goes on the other side of the road and doesn't stop. And then a Levite, it says, goes by, a man of the tribe of Levi, and passes him up also. But then a Samaritan comes along. And the Samaritans and the Jews were, you know, really at enmity. They were not friends with each other. And the Samaritan takes the man, binds his wounds, and nurtures him best he can, takes him into an inn, a place where he can stay for a few days, and tells the innkeeper, look, you keep him and look after him. Here's some money. And when I come back, if it takes you more money than this to help him to heal, I'll give you more. And it's a profound parable about caring for those who are in some ways we deem our enemies, or about seeing the image of God in all people. Those and how often we look past caring the way that we should for others. We walk on the other side of the road instead of stopping to help. That point you made about how whites define racism, because they look at that parable differently. I wonder if I can read part of your book on this, or you can just talk to it. What's your, do you have a preference?
Go ahead.
Okay. Here's one thing that you say. You say the story of the Good Samaritan helps me better understand the way many whites define racism versus the way people of color define it. Whites often think that racism is confined to a person's attitude and actions. They didn't enslave anyone, lynch anyone, or insult anyone, so racism isn't their problem. They are like the two religious men who walk on by the wounded man. There is no need to get involved, they think, when the problem has nothing to do with them. People of color, however, see the larger definition of racism, the entire system that pervades our society. In Jesus' story, he's not concerned with who caused the problem. Passersby are responsible simply because the problem exists. The pain of our neighbor, who is all humanity, demands that we take action.
It's a great reading.
I love it.
Yes, no, because my point here is not really like dwelling and like, okay, you know why? That's because not me. I'm good. Kumbaya, see you next door. It's rather, okay, if there is a problem here, then, okay, if the problem exists, how can we come together to find a solution together? Instead of like pointing fingers, okay, this is us, it's not me. This is I versus them. That's why it's like the whole thing is here. Again, it can be very, very, we have a lot of like temptation here, right? Because once I am in my privilege, it's very, very hard for me to feel the pain and injustice this problem is causing, because I'm not, I don't feel it, because I'm already located in my privileged place. But do I have enough spiritual sensitivity? And do I have the spiritual visions that allow me to see systemically there is something here? And there's, how can I engage in this?
It's a great, great, great point. And I think that choice of that parable is a great example of how when we don't see these problems, when we don't try to learn how to understand and perceive structural racism, we really are like the two who walk by on the other side of the road. I didn't cause it, you know, not my problem. I've got other problems to worry about. But it demands that we learn to see it. I think that's a great, it's a really beautiful reading of that parable, Patrick. I think it's profound. You move in week three, we move in week three with the book, you know, to, this is a week that's, you title, The Crucifixion and the Suffering of People of Color. And in this third week, you ask us to reflect, to ponder, to imagine, to sit with Christ's suffering on the cross. And you extend that suffering to people of color who experience racial injustice. And I really appreciate this passage here and wonder whether you'd comment on it. You write, quoting you, We have sometimes limited our understanding of the cross to each person's individual relationship with God. But Scripture makes clear that the cross was not only for our individual healing and spiritual salvation, it also had another goal, the bringing together of people who had been separated by ethnic divisions. This is not secondary or incidental to our personal salvation. It is part and parcel of the healing work of the crucifixion. In Jesus' supreme act of self-giving on the cross, he demolished the barriers that separated people. It's a great passage. Yes. Can you comment on that?
Yes, no, definitely. Definitely, because like the symbol of the cross in itself, it's really like a call for unity to remember, engage, and unite. We cannot come to the cause with our simple agenda and our simple motif. As we really prefer to be in the glory of the cause, while we have forgotten what was the motif of the existence of the coming of the cause. And Jesus Christ was very, very clear. The cross has come, we like to unite, to break those barriers that's like north, south, west, and east, white, yellow, black, native. That was the first mission of the cross. This is why the main reason for the incarnations. And when Jesus Christ had very, very kids, went to the temple, listening, that's a way, okay, how can I bring those people together? And all the way to Calvary, walking with the cross, the whole like crowd was behind him. And I think the symbolisms in the cross very, very clear. You can see that. We can imagine right now as you really see where Jesus Christ was on the cross. They have three courses. It's not so innocent that the cross of Jesus was right in the middle. It was his invitation to bring all together. However, today, we decided to do otherwise.
Yeah.
Again, because this deep crisis of the spiritual imaginations.
Yeah, thank you for that. I really appreciate that vision. And you're right. I mean, I think that's beautiful about that symbolism of Jesus' cross in the middle in a way of bringing together all of us. You know, the passage that I just read from is taken from day 3 of week 3. Again, all of these sections are built over 7 days with exercises attached to them. And at the conclusion of that section, day 3 of week 3, when we shift from reflection to practice, because you always have a section of the book that reflects with us on the topic, and then you have some exercise at the end.
Good, this is work. This is work.
This is the way. Sorry, this is why this book is more of a manual, not just like a novel you glance through, right? You observe that carrying the cross of Jesus means making anti-racism a way of life. And I want to visit a few of the things you mentioned that we can do as listeners, and perhaps you can comment on one or two of them. Here are some ways we can carry a cross, okay? You mention voting for candidates in local elections who seek to address racial injustice, reading books by authors of color, participating in local marches or protests, celebrating Juneteenth, attending a black church, creating something that speaks to racial justice, donating money to organizations that advocate for social justice, and more. It's a great list.
Yes, because, you know, it's a spiritual work. It's not just we have to express ourselves and it's okay, you know, guys, we're going to do. But we need to go out there, put actions in our prayers, put actions in our expression of love, put actions in the way that we can show that we believe. In fact, the way we act, that's what my grandmother, who's someone who really brought me into this work, it was always said, you know, the way you choose to be with others, that's what would express how you believe.
It's a great point. There's a lot of wisdom in that statement of your grandmother's. A lot of wisdom. And I'll come back here to say something. You list all these things. Your point is not that we all need to do everything. It's back to spiritual discernment. We should be discerning what God wants us to do, right?
Yes, no, it takes, you know, bring all of those to prayer, and in based on like, what do I have? What do I need? Based on that, what that allow me to do? Because I need to act, right? Pray, and then once you bring that to your prayers, you discern, God will always lead us on the right path. I mean, so far, one thing I can guarantee you for certain, I'm not quite kind of like these radical guys. I never want to say certain, but these are like few time I said for certain, 100%. I'm even like 200%. One thing I can guarantee you, God has never failed me. Never failed. The moment I pray him for some things, he always come and deliver. And I can guarantee every your listeners right now, they can try it out. Bring all of those to at your table. Bring them to the family, at your work, at your school, wherever you are. Bring them on your deeply on yourself. Discern, but God will always come with you. Always come with you.
That's a beautiful vision, and one that I would certainly affirm myself. Thank you for that, Patrick. That's much appreciated. Let me turn here to week four, which you title, again, it's very evocative. I love this week. You title it Resurrection and the Power of Possibility. And you observe in this last section that resurrection does not ignore pain. It transforms pain. And it does so in the here and now. And I'm wondering, do you, when you look around, do you see signs of that transformation occurring at a social level? Are you heartened by what you see? Or are you disheartened by what you see when you look around us in our social moment?
You know, Matt, the power, the eschatological power of the resurrections is really like, it's a gift that has been given to human beings. Is to engage in our work of faith with possibility and remember the cause will not last forever, yet it's going to come here. We have to go through it for transformations. And this transformation always is there. I mean, we might have many, many things around in our eyes that can discourage you. Say, you know, oh no, you've been trying for so long, it's not going to happen. And that's according to us, our human perception and understanding. But again, I'm going to repeat that again. The moment you put God on it, he will not let you by yourself because God has never failed anyone. In fact, he doesn't know how to do that.
Yeah, so that's a good observation.
No, I dare God to fail someone. Yes. Right. I bet you. If you want to bet with me, let's go. $5. God cannot fail you.
Yeah, I think that's profound. I do believe.
Yeah. Possibility.
I think that's really, really great. I do believe that there are Jobian moments for every person, that there are times we face real hardship and it seems as though God is not present. But not seeing God directly or immediately does not mean that God is not there. It does not mean we're being failed. Correct. Right? This is the important point that you're making, yeah.
Yeah, this is exactly where I'm inviting people, you know, to try to build this spiritual culture of possibility, you know.
Great.
Really, this spiritual culture of possibilities is where really, like, it's hard. You know, so many of us right now, you know, cancer, like, you have a systemic issue that's happening, and in anger and so, yes, but I'm not trying to say that those issues are not existing, you're not there, and then guards just like go and then sit down on his picture and then enjoy having a good time. No. But how we like cannot find God somewhere here. And okay, you know, these are things has been coming to life. But how is that can be a moment of encounter for me? And what is the transformation, the possible transformation that I can get here?
Yeah, that's great. You're a person of, I think, great faith and a lot of depth, a lot of insight, Patrick. It's really terrific. One more thing on this fourth week, and you call racism is a very powerful. You call it a culture of death, and you write something that I find heartbreaking. And I'm quoting you here from the book: "People of color carry the negative legacy of the past. Researchers are finding that intergenerational trauma is a reality. Black babies have significantly higher levels of stress hormones than white babies. Their bodies already bear the weight of racial injustice." And it's so heartbreaking to read and think about that. But of course, it's true. It's exactly right what you're saying. There is research on this. You know, I believe, you know, as a Christian, I believe in a literal resurrection and bodies made perfect. But I'm interested in asking you, what might transformation for intergenerationally traumatized bodies look like in the world as we presently experience it? How can we experience that kind of rebirth in the here and now?
I think, you know, this really aspect actually is a way I was like tweaking some other academic work that I do, because I work on RPTSS, religious post-traumatic slave syndromes, which is like how that's explained, how trauma passed from one generation to the next and how that's indexed from the DNA based on some epigenetics study that I've been doing here in my lab and so on and so forth. And really like, try to engage here, Matt, with your questions. It's really like, how can we finally engage in these conversations with ourselves to see those, really like, to recognize those bodies, which is or not looks like the same color of our skins, or traumatized. And some of those cause of this trauma is the system that's ingrained that. And where is that leading us? And we like, as you talk about like these transformations of the body here, really is to see and recognize that, again, there is some things here and try to understand it. Number one, I think the first thing is that recognize the existence of this trauma and this body. Then we can engage here in the conversations to see where is God is leading us. And, you know, again, there is where the power of our faith come at play. After all that we see that happened to Jesus, the Christ himself was traumatized. His body was traumatized. But you know why? The power of the possibility said, this is not the last word. I'm going to give you this glorified body. This is where our hope comes in. No matter what happened, we are not only disasters. We are also miracle. Our bodies would be a way that's carrying and leading us to connect with our faith. And that's where Christ comes to meet us.
We're not only disasters, we're miracles. What a great phrase. That the entire answer there, Patrick, is really wonderful. And it shows me, this is a classic instance of how your work as a theologian and your work in psychology really do unite and give you that perspective. About intergenerational trauma, which is a psychological phenomenon, but how it connects to the larger theological vision you're sharing with us and sharing in that book. I love it. Thank you. You know, after the 28 days of reflections and exercises, you know, you give us two more days on contemplating divine love. And on one of these 2 days, you ask us to reflect on what God is asking of us. And you know, clearly, you're responsive to the call of God in your own life. I'm curious whether you have any sense of what God will ask of you next. You've written this glorious book. It's wonderful, you know. Will it be some follow-up on this, or is there some other thing that you're feeling maybe led to be directed to do?
If you remember, Matt, in the very, very beginning of our conversation here today, I told you like what my grandmother has given me, how I grew up.
Yes.
And our faith is to really like have this culture of like spiritual openness. And I'm open and spiritually curious and grateful to see what God's going to say to ask of me. I have another book that's coming out with Obi's book in February, pretty much. It's a second version of this book.
Oh, great.
Which is really like, again, it's more challenging, if you will. And I'm working against another book right now, and I have some other works. But to be honest with you, those are like what I think I'm engaging with, but I'm really, really open. I don't know what the Spirit really, where is going to lead me. But for certain, I know He has never failed me, and I know He will not. And I'm really open and engaged for the power of possibility. That's what I would also invite your listeners here to. After all that happened, you know, I please trust me. Let's give God a second chance again. Give Him a second opportunity, because He had given us so many, and He never let us behind. I think it's again, it's a way to engage. Same things. Now, I invite people, you know, come and just work in. This is, again, this is a book to work with your family, your children at work. I mean, by yourself, if you want. Your journal is for by yourself, but bring the book always by, one for you, one for your cousin, your nephew, your godchildren. Let's sit together here. Let's sit together. And I think we do have hope. Hope is invented every day. The moment we come here, and the idea you have to engage in these conversations is already a glimpse of hope. It's already a glimpse of hope. We have to be a little bit very, very careful here to not really like fall on this trap of illusion self-sufficiency. Knowing that what we already inspire about ourselves, it's what God really like is asking of us. And we have much more to do, and God will not let us by ourselves. If God has put the desire in our heart, He will always show us the way to live it.
I love the faith and hope you exude, Patrick. I mean, I think your attitude that you share really is part of the solution of the problems that we face. I think it's wonderful. Let me ask you one more thing before we conclude the interview. And I can't thank you enough for your time. This is so great. In some ways, racial justice matters bear a similarity to the problem of climate change, right? And that real solutions need to be large in scale and must be achieved, therefore, at some level at the political level, right? And given that likely fact, if we're really going to solve climate problems or here racial problems, it's got to be big scale. Given that likely fact, what is the value of addressing racial justice at the individual level of spiritual exercise, of my going inside myself, right, first, so as to go outward? What do we gain by that kind of practice that we might not gain if we focused exclusively on political outcomes?
I think this is where Ignatius really is very important here, Ignatian spirituality. This is why it's such a fundamental tool for today's challenges we are facing in the whole world. Because first of all, He invited us to go in, but use in as a launch pad to engage with outdoor, right? But also, He gave us like the gift of discernment, right? The spiritual discernment, so that we can open our eyes to be aware of those even like political actions. Is that really like leading you to God? And is that something that really like taking care of the creations? Is that something that really involves the whole God's creations? Otherwise, if it's not from God. That's the questions we need to really, really ask here. Some of those political actions, because as Christians today, I think we have to pray for God to help us, like, you know, to balance what can come as impact, external impact, superficial impact, based on fact. Because more than ever, our country, as you can see, Matt, we've never faced this like deep spiritual dissonance, as I said here, in questions of how we've been like, we split together. We never like, since 1863, our country was never like so divided as we are today. That's where we really, we have to bring that to these conversations.
You know, you talk about discernment, and I totally agree with what you say there, Patrick. You talk about discernment, and I think this book you've written is such a discerning book. It's deeply wise. It's deeply humane. It's such a wonderful illustration of intelligence about how to approach these matters in ways that are faithful and hopeful and unifying. And I think it's just wonderful. Again, the book is The Spiritual Work of Racial Justice, A Month of Meditations with Ignatius of Loyola. Thank you so much, Patrick, for your time and for your beautiful work. And God's blessing to you.
No, many thanks to you, Matt. Many thanks to everyone. Please pray for me. And I'm looking forward to see each and every one of you very soon. Maybe I'm coming to BYU very soon.
Okay. Love that. Would love that. All right. Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you very much, Matt.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination Podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Abby Thatcher and Bobby May. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.